Well, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 3rd, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is John Paul. It's session number 98-4, and it's titled Beginnings, Middles, and Endings, the Good News in Liturgical Drama. Let's listen in.
The three shepherds are in their house, and they pull back the cover a little bit, and they see the sheep, and they say, he's ugly. and the wife, whose name is Gil, is putting on a perfect act about how beautiful this child is and how not to call him names. And finally, the sheep bleats like a sheep, and so the shepherds figure it out, and they take the sheep thief out, and they don't kill him. They put it into a blanket and toss it up. And then there's a big change, and the shepherds go from there to the manger to see the real baby Jesus with Mary now. And so it's a wonderful analogy. And it's a great play to do. Even though it's 600 years old, it just works like a charm. Well, it's nice to see you here. I may adjust my speech a little bit, but I think for the sake of the tape, I should say that my name is John Stephen Paul, and I'm professor of theater and television arts at Valparaiso University. This session, the fourth in four, is called Beginnings, Middles, and Ends, the Good News in Liturgical Drama. And I'm sorry if this looks like a college lecture up here. I just have to do a little background, which I hope I can do very quickly, just to raise some issues that will get us to questions which have been concerning us. And I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about this play that we read in draft yesterday, and talk about some further thinking that I've had about that. So let me just start here. Aristotle, the great philosopher of Athens, in the late 4th century BC, came up with a definition of what he called tragedy, which we might now call drama. He called it the imitation of an action, of a human action, something that somebody does. And he describes it in three or four lines in this definition. But he says the imitation now should be serious, complete, and of a certain length, a certain magnitude. It's this word complete that I'd like to talk about today. Because he goes on later in the book to talk about what he means by complete, and he says that every imitation should have a beginning and a middle and an end. And I remember thinking when I learned this in college, how obvious that was to say that. Well, everything has to start somewhere. There has to be a middle, doesn't there? And it should end somewhere. I mean, why is that such a deep insight? Well, it turns out in the question of plays to be a very important question and a very significant insight. When we go to plays, and I would include here stage plays and movies and television shows as well, what draws us in, for the most part, is the way the plot works. That is the way the story is shaped. Character is important, and language is important, and ideas are important. But it's the plot which captures us. And when we like a play, whether we know it or not, that in the beginning poses some question which keeps us interested, which sets up one side of a suspense, one terminus of a suspense is that the right way to say that? We start the suspense by establishing one terminus, a question. And we'd like that question to be clear so that we understand what this play is going to be about. In the middle of a play, we want to see obstacles put up in the way of answering that question. How is that question going to be answered? Yes or no? Will he or won't he? Will she or won't she? And these obstacles need to be real ones. They need to be difficult. The more difficult they are, the more interesting they are. And in the end, we do like some answer to come through. We might also call it a resolution. A yes or no answer. That satisfies our desire for completion. Now, I have here this word art, and linking it to imitation. It is in art only, I think, that segments of our life seem to have beginnings and middles and ends. Our own lives don't have. That's one of our problems. There's not a lot of closure in our lives. Things don't come to end, and it's hard to know once you're in the middle of something where it began. Well, that's why we like to go to the movies or to the theater, because you know you can see where this started and it does come to an end. So I just have a couple examples here to show you what I mean. Aristotle's favorite tragedy, Oedipus Rex. The question at the beginning of Oedipus Rex is, and it's stated very clearly by someone coming back from an oracle, who killed King Laius? That's what's the problem here. Everybody in Thebes is sick, and they're all their crops are dying, and they're not having any children. Why is that? Well, somebody killed King Laius. Who killed King Laius? In the middle of Oedipus, there is a series of interrogations. It could be this person, it could be this person, it could be this person. And finally, we come to a point where a shepherd comes in and makes it clear that there's only one answer to this question, and it is indeed Oedipus himself. The person who posed the question, who killed King Laius, turns out to be the answer. It's the great tragic irony. Oedipus. And that shepherd brought in news. He came in toward the end of the play and said something in such a way that there is no other answer to the question. So we would have to say this was bad news for Oedipus. There's no way around it now. He is culpable. And thus Oedipus Rex is a tragedy. It's a tragic imitation. The news was bad. Twelfth Night, one of Shakespeare's great comedies. If you know that play, you know that it begins with a young woman being washed up on a shore from a shipwreck with a sea captain, is the only person who seems to admit from the ship. And the question is, what will happen to her? She believes now that everybody else is lost, including her twin brother Sebastian. Her name is Viola. The question is very clear right in the beginning. What's going to happen to this poor woman? The middle then begins. She disguises herself as a man and goes to the local duke, a man named Orsino, and volunteers to serve him as a man. He thinks that Viola is a man. She's disguised herself apparently perfectly so that he believes she's a man. Well, then the complications begin, and in a comedy, the complications are difficult, but they tend to be so strange that they're funny as things go this way and that way, and how is this possibly going to be resolved? In Twelfth Night, of course, the Duke is in love with a countess who's not too far away named Olivia, and so he sends Viola, who's disguised as a man, with a kind of embassy of his love to Olivia, and Olivia falls in love with the messenger, Viola. Dressed as a man. Well, this is going to make the Duke, who loves the woman, very unhappy. And how is this all going to be sorted out? And it becomes funnier and funnier until, very near the end, the twin brother shows up, Sebastian. He hasn't died in the shipwreck. He comes on shore. There are a few complications because they look exactly alike. They're twins. But when he goes to see Olivia, the Countess, she thinks it's the first person she fell in love with. She transfers her love to him, which frees his sister, who in the meantime has fallen in love with the Duke. And at the end of the play, there are two marriages, Viola and Orsino, and now Sebastian and Olivia. The news was carried by the twin brother Sebastian, and it was good news. I'm alive, and here's how this is going to be sorted out. And it's sorted out with marriage. That's a comedy. The Church. Chekhov, maybe his greatest play, Cherry Archer. It's a story that takes place in Russia in the first decade of this 20th century. A group of people who have lived on an estate for generations called the Cherry Orchard, but through sort of frittering and diddling, they've fallen behind on their taxes, and they've fallen behind on this payment or on another payment, and it appears that the estate is going to have to be sold, their family estate. So the question is posed at the beginning, will the cherry orchard indeed be sold? What will happen to these people? Now the middle is not so much complications in the cherry orchard as it is a slow realization that there is something they could do about this. There are remedies to their problem. But they also realize they're not going to do anything about it because they simply cannot change. Change is beyond them. Then, toward the end, near the end, news comes that someone has bought the cherry orchard. It's someone that they know very well. In fact, a former serf on their estate has risen up, become a capitalist, made enough money to buy the estate. He's bought the estate, and now everybody has to leave. But just at the end, it seems possible that the guy who bought the estate might be in love and marry one of the daughters of the former owners. They come this close, and then they change the subject, and they walk away from one another. So what makes this particularly poignant, it's hard to call it a tragedy, because the news, well, yes, the news is bad, but it was right there. All they had to do was grab it. Yes, it would have meant change for them. They would have had to divide up the estate and sold it for vacation cottages, but it was right there. They could have gotten married. Things would have been okay, but they don't. And that is so much like life, like real life. We see what we could have, but we can't take it. And this is why Chekhov is known as one of the great realistic playwrights. But his plays are bummers. They're just terribly disappointing. And yet they seem almost more like life than they do like art. It's very hard to check off well. He's not popular. He's too much like life, I think. So, there you have sort of three templates. And which one do you want to go see? Now let's move back to the medieval mystery plays cycles that we were talking about yesterday. Remember that these mystery cycles had between 30 to 50 plays in them. The first one was always the creation play. Each one of those plays was done separately. They were done over the course of 2 or 3 days. They would sometimes be done on pageant wagons that would be drawn into the marketplace. A play would be done, that wagon would be pulled away, another play would be done, etc. Now, in the medieval mystery cycle told the story of the world. From God's point of view. So, very early in the cycle, Adam and Eve sin, and God's perfect world is ruined. And we wonder, as Adam and Eve leave the garden, what's going to happen now? After all, we're only in about play number three, and we've got 47 more to go. What's going to happen to this perfect world that God made? And the complications could be seen in all these individual plays. Because in each one of these plays is the story of people who do the wrong thing. They see a promise of redemption that looks forward, but it doesn't really, the redemption doesn't happen, it's postponed. So there's complication after complication after complication. Of course, the news comes in that there is Jesus who is going to be who's going to be sacrificed in order to redeem the world. And there's always in these plays a crucifixion play. So the news is definitely good. It's the news of the gospel. This is how God will redeem the world. Comedy, right? It's a divine comedy. The problem is that the play does not end, the cycle does not end with Easter. The cycle play always goes to the Last Judgment. And the Last Judgment play in all the cycles that are extant is based on Matthew chapter 25. When the king comes arrayed in glory at the end of time, he sees all the people on his right hand and all the people on his left hand, and he says to them, you did what you should have done. You were good to the least of these members of my family. Come in, you sheep on my right. You people on my left, you goats, you were not hospitable. You did not go to see the sick or visit people in prison or clothe the naked or feed the hungry. You go off to hell, weeping, moaning, gnashing of teeth. That's the way the play ends. That's the way the cycle ends. So it's a kind of comedy because the news has been good, but there is that sense, that almost Jacobian sense, maybe. It's pushing a little, I suppose. That there's a lot of people, and I don't know how you decide on proportions here, but there are a lot of people who saw the good news and for whatever reason did not believe it, did not accept it. They did not take the remedy offered to them. Which one of these models then do we offer to people who are watching liturgical drama in church, if we're going to do drama for church? Which one do you want to see? Just ask me.
I want good news.
You want comedy. You want, and I don't, by the way, I don't think that it's wrong at all to talk about comedy, even though comedy has a lot of other connotations for us, but we're talking about comic form here. You want there to be good news, and it ends up, in the end, with people happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What about you, Dave?
it's a more complicated question. Because we've talked often about drama in worship somehow needs to proclaim the good news. And yet, I think there can be very effective drama in the context of worship that can show real life. You know, and that not all respond to that. There can be open-ended, there can be disappointment. There can be a dramatic portrayal of the good news being rejected and what happens to a person in those circumstances. So there can be tragedy.
It's a funny thing about these resolutions, I think. I think we somehow want it both ways, a lot of people. I mean, we do want that resolution because so much of our own lives are unresolved, and we go to the theater or to the movie and we want resolution, and yet we're suspicious of resolution, mm-hmm. Perfect resolution, because it's so unlifelike. So there has to be, a playwright or a screenwriter is always playing with that tension. How do you provide resolution while at the same time not making it seem so unlifelike that it's hokey or cheesy or sweet or not satisfying in some way?
I was just thinking of one of not chancel drama in worship, mm-hmm. but secular film, the movie Tender Mercies. If you recall that, the Robert Duvall piece where, you know, there's, in a sense, you know, the good news is brought to him through this Tess Harper figure who, you know, cleans him up. He's an alcoholic, you know, if you've seen the movie. It's a tremendous thing. I don't think Robert Duvall's in anything bad, but he's a broken-down country western singer, wounds up in a drunk in this middle of this barren Texas plain, and this Vietnam widow and her son who run a little roadside theater or roadside hotel take him in. He does odd jobs, and gradually he cleans up his life and gets sober and asks her to marry him. And they get married, and there's this wonderful baptism. It's an incredible theological movie for Hollywood. But in the very end, his daughter, who he had been estranged from, is killed in a car accident. And in the last scene, he's out in the garden in this bleak Texas, you know, stuff, and he's saying to her, you know, why did that happen to her? You know, why did God take her? Why did I end up here? You know, and you take me in and marry me, clean me up. Why, you know, why is it? I've never trusted happiness and never will, you know. And then, I forget who the director is, but the movie doesn't end then with that. But the kid comes home from school and he's got a football. And they go out across the highway from this bleak, you know, scene, and they just start tossing the football back and forth. And they're laughing, you know, and tossing the football, and that's how. And then the credits start coming up. You know, it's just this, you know, very wonderful story of how this guy's life is redeemed, and yet it's not. Everybody lived happily ever after. You know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the center of the movie, I guess the point is that the center of the movie is the Christian gospel. You know, where this guy is. Declared to be loved by this woman, and that God even loves him, and that God's tender mercies will watch over him, and he decides to get baptized.
And there is a sense that he's able to sustain the football tossing at the end offers some hope that he will not have lost that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of embarrassed not to have seen that movie.
It's a wonderful line in the movie where when he is baptized, the little boy is baptized, it's a Baptist church, and they're driving back in the pickup truck, and the little kid who is just admiring now this new father figure kind of looks at him and says, well, we're baptized. He goes, yep. He goes, you feel any different yet? And his reply is, not yet. You know, it's just a tremendous hopeful line, you know, for a lesson. I'm sorry.
No, appreciate it. Yeah. I was just thinking that last week when Soul Purpose was here, we did one of our plays, which is called The Brother. You were here for that film?
I wasn't here for that, but I've seen it.
Yeah. This is a story about, it's an interpretation of the prodigal son. It's set in Western ranch country, and it's a father and his son. His wife and his mother have died. The woman has died. So they find out that their brother is coming home. His name is Alex, and when he comes home, he tells his father, who's very glad to see him and has a big party and invites all everybody in, then he has AIDS. The older brother is just absolutely appalled by this. Not only is he resentful of the fact that both his father and his mother seem to have favored this younger son, or at least forgiven him time and time and time again, but now with AIDS and with his death being imminent, he's going to bring a shame to the family, which had established itself and had a good reputation. We never see the prodigal son. We only see the older brother struggling with this. And in the course of in the middle of the play, the brother has a very tough discussion with his father. And the father finally says, look, no one has to know about this. He's probably going to die from cancer related to AIDS. And we will we'll tell people he has cancer, and when it finally comes time for him to die, we'll take him to Laramie or to Denver to die. No one will have to know about this, the father says this. And the brother says, well, no one but us, right? I mean, we're going to have to deal with this, with the shame of this. Then the brother is distraught, and he goes to the cemetery, to his mother's gravestone. And he has this sort of excruciating, quote, conversation with her, in which he tells her, you know, how many times she forgave this young boy, his younger brother, who did this and that terrible thing. And now, you know, now he'll be dead and he'll be with you again, Mom, like he always was, sitting on your lap. Anyway, he just goes through all this pain. And at the end of the play, the father comes back in to the brother, and he says, well, you can come home now. The brother wouldn't go home as long as the Alex was there. You can come home now, he's gone. He took some money, he took one of the cars, they were his to take, he's gone off toward Laramie. So at the end, you have the brother standing there, trying to decide what to do, whether to follow his father home, or go after his younger brother, and we take it to minister to him or to reconcile. But the play ends without that question being answered. What's that brother going to do? Well, the people were very disturbed by this here in Boulder, because it's the classic unresolved question. And people who have liked this play over the years have told us, you know, this is just so much like what would really happen. No one makes a decision at that point, that quickly, to say, okay, he's my brother, if you love him, Dad, if you love him, Mom, then I can love him too. But that just doesn't work that way, even if that would be to follow the model of Jesus. But that play always gets a very strong reaction, both positive and negative. Because it is unresolved.
According to dramatic theory, then, here, you know, and much of at least published stuff that, you know, that I've so far come across, is precisely, you know, follows a wonderful resolution thing, and is precisely what I don't like about a lot of, you know, chancel dramas. Quote.
Real simple ones for high school youth, and they dismiss them all, saying, this is just too cut and dry. It's just too easy, and it's not the way it is for us.
Oh, Mom and Dad, I'm on drugs. Oh, that's terrible. Well, here, Jesus loves you. Oh, okay.
I know.
You know. That's the play. Yeah.
Yeah. They read through a few short ones. And, you know, we don't do this.
And what do you think? Do you work with youth? I mean, you read through these. What? And we have youth with us.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you?
What
do you think they want? No.
Real.
What is real?
Issues more that they're struggling with. A lot of times, it's even believing in faith or believing in Christ. It's among them, if you really ask, they're really struggling. Some of them are. They're all kind of, it's just, you know, so. And how to deal, the ones who believe, how to not be ashamed that they believe, because no one at school does. So they kind of hide it. So it's really good to get them with other kids. But getting them to open up is a little bit of a trick, too. The whole group. Just, yeah. Especially if you're a parent, some of them.
Do you think any resolution, whether it's tragic or comic or something in the middle like the Chekhov, any resolution makes sense, or is it just contrived? Is it just arty?
Well, I think in the case of the play you're just talking about, I think if you do resolve the play, I think that might lead to sort of a stoppage. You stop pondering the main questions. I think if you don't resolve it, then you're left asking yourself more and more, what would I have done in that situation, or
for growth.
Right. If it's answered for you, there's no reason to think.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say there's no reason to think, but I would say that
less reason.
I think you're really forced to think about it more if it's not decided for you there at the end. You know, if he chooses to not follow his brother or to follow his brother, I think that, like, you know, I think it leaves room for thinking that.
Now, one person said to me right after the play was over, in quite emotional terms, she said, the answer isn't even suggested there. She thought that what had never been said in that play was, I'm sorry. No one ever had admitted they were wrong, that they had caused pain. This is the brother. And she said, well, maybe it doesn't have to be resolved, but we ought to be able to see what could resolve it. You know, it's not even suggested. And that made me go back and look at the text and say, well, maybe that's true. Maybe there isn't even an image there to hang on to.
I'm not sure a person who causes heartache does say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that would be true of the biblical text.
That was my own thought. if what she was saying is that if it's to be a recasting in somewhat of the prodigal son, that very clearly the way the parable was told, the prodigal son comes to his senses, and does not think he is worthy to deserve the father's love. And my take goes on that story is that the word prodigal almost refers to the father rather than the son, because the outlandish, overbearing, extravagant, stuff in the story is not the guy's wild lifestyle, but indeed the father's love for this son. But there is that element of repentance.
Yeah, because he did return.
And in this case, the son returns, but it just doesn't happen on stage. Mm-hmm. It's reported. So it doesn't have quite the same concrete quality as other events that happen.
It's more about the brother.
Yeah. Now, in our other plays, the resolution is stronger. In our play called Zacchaeus, which we read a little bit of on Monday, the first part is the story of Zacchaeus, pretty much right from Luke. But at the end of that story, and the play goes further than the story, and Zacchaeus gets his opportunity to give back fourfold what he's taken from people, and he gives his material things away. And then he is so interested in what happens to Jesus, he goes to Jerusalem and gets there in time for the triumphal entry in Jerusalem. And the play becomes kind of metaphorical at that point, because we skip over several days and he finds himself on Golgotha as the centurion comes up looking for a cross. And Zacchaeus is sort of conscripted, shanghaied, into assisting the centurion to put the cross up. There's a procession with Jesus coming up and coming and being put on the cross, so to speak. And now Zacchaeus is part of the crowd. And the play ends with the Matthew 25 reference. That is, Jesus is on the cross, and he is saying, he is separating the sheep from the goats, in a way. Actually, what he's saying is that those people who have been hospitable, fed the hungry, clothed the naked, visited people in prison, will have a home with him in heaven. And we are Zacchaeus, kind of watching this whole thing take place. The good news embodied, crucified, died, and that's sort of where the story ends, and Zacchaeus and his wife go back home then, feeling kind of desolate. And the last word of the play is, but Jesus is coming back. And there's a little joke, and Jesus reaffirms the fact that he's serious. He is coming back. It's hard to retell that, but there is the image of the good news. But who exactly will be saved is not entirely clear at the end. It's unresolved. Am I saying that right, do you think? So we have the image of Christ, but not the resolution so much. Well, I'm interested in this idea about faith itself being a question. That may be something for us to work on.
Maybe that's what happens when you have 20-year-old sons that are in college and they're really struggling with it.
Yeah.
I think the seeds are there, but the plant's kind of waiting to grow. Although I have a daughter who says, how can you not believe? It's part of my being. So, but there's a couple others, and you know, there's several guys, and they don't say much in our group, but they, you know, they come, they're searching, they're seeking. They don't want some little watered down Sunday school version. They want something that's really there. And I don't know exactly how to give that to them, but except listen sometimes and not say, what do you mean? You aren't sure you believe? Out the door. This isn't a place to question. No, this kind of really, really searching.
Yeah. We're in the answers business here, not in the questions business. In church, there has to be one more question, one more answer than there is question.
But I think what I'm hearing being said is that for drama and worship to truly be, to have integrity as art as well,
yeah,
is that it cannot only give answers, that it must absolutely give integrity to the question and the interesting and difficult obstacles. If faith is the question, you know, response to Christ is the question. And that's what I don't see being done very well. Is
art.
But
you get a lot of people who would question whether or not art belongs,
in
real
worship.
Art belongs in the worship anyway.
Right.
That seems to me to be a pretty fairly controversial thing. Mm-hmm. Whether there should be anything approaching true dramatic art within the context of a worship service. Mm-hmm. That's where you're into the danger zone.
Where is that rooted in, that controversy? I don't want to say blasphemous, but I mean, is it just the merging of two things that are seen as opposites and...
Oh, I don't know where that would be rooted. I think that's, I mean, I haven't thought about that. Yes.
It reminds me of when my daughter introduced liturgical dance in our church. And going out afterwards, I heard one woman behind me say something like, "Seems like more like a show than a service."
Yeah.
I know that she used the word show, but she said service or something, the church, or show, seemed more like a show.
Yeah, and I've heard that too, and I think that's such that response is so stinging that one could come back with a ready answer for that, but it's a very complex issue, because to a certain extent, I think especially high liturgical worship has a show quality to it. There is a display that's very important, a visual display.
I think it's a lot in sort of getting used to the form. After, we heard a few things that first year or so, and then people got used to it and started appreciating it. There have been studies made, for example, that people watching dance have muscular responses. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that a person can watch good theater without having emotional responses and all kinds of responses.
Yeah, and that opens up a big question about the sort of status of the body in worship. There's a wonderful book that I use in class by Tom Driver, who is an emeritus professor at Union Theological Seminary, called The Magic of Ritual, in which he talks about how important physicality is to religious ritual, and yet how we have, especially in what he calls mainline Protestant churches, have become suspect of bodies in worship and physical engagement in worship.
I wonder if that's why robes,
sure,
way, covers
I'm
up
sure,
the body.
I'm sure.
And then when a dancer comes on and is using his or her body and clothed in such a way that the lines of the body can be seen, some people respond or cringe from that. I mean, mm-hmm. Show she's got breasts, for Pete's sake.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, I remember, this shows you how old I am, I remember when our church first started to do handshakes for the peace of the Lord, and this was like we were all having sex with one another or something, and so there is something, pretty deeply rooted. I think it's cultural, more than anything.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I know that it's questionable to mix theater with liturgy. My experience, I think that most people who attend churches that I've been to have no problem going to watch a secular movie or a secular play, but it's the two at the same time. I would think maybe some people who are really zealous might not, even delve into secular plays and movies.
It seems like such a wonderful means of bringing things to life, because sometimes the words just become words buzzing past me. Yeah.
You're used to the same old stories
and
the same old
way. And here
you've
got it brought into life with a visual effect. It seems like it would be so much more potent than just the words. Now, I know the word is supposed to be enough, but having different ways, I just think it's a real exciting thing, maybe not to do every week, but, you know, and once a season or something.
If anything, the sermon's usually just a dramatic monologue anyway. I mean, not just, but I mean, it seems very similar to one. It's one person telling a story. It's a speech.
There's another model for this, too, and it has been made sort of really popular by a megachurch near Chicago called Willow Creek, which has a congregation of something like 20,000 people. They have searcher services. They call them searcher services on weekends. And they use drama extensively, in fact, every week. And they have a drama department with the professional director on their staff. And what they do, as I understand it, well, and I've seen their stuff, is that they, speaking theoretically, do this much. They will begin with a very difficult question. And the one that I saw was a couple who had gone through, who were infertile, and they had done fertility treatments, and then they decided to adopt, and they had a baby waiting for them. And they were packing to putting their things together to go to the hospital to pick up the baby. Okay, so we've come from beginning to middle, right? Phone rings. It's the hospital. A lawyer from the hospital. It's off. The people who were going to give you this baby have taken the loophole, and this is not going to happen. The wife is absolutely devastated by this. And she says, I can never pray again. End of play. I mean, the play stops. I don't want to say the play ends. The play stops. Minister comes on, preaches for 35 minutes about how to pray in the midst of trouble. Now, you hear in my voice, I wasn't trying. I don't like that because I'm in theater, and I think playwrights have the right and privilege and responsibility to end their plays. I think truncating a play at the point of the highest action like that, it just goes against my sense of what a play is. I don't want to say it's wrong because, I mean, I'm sure that it brings a lot of people, I'm sure that form brings a lot of people who are searching to that church. And the director says, and you know what? We are not preachers. We're not theologians. We're theater people. We don't have to give the answer. We just have to get people ready to listen.
I was just going to say, everyone's ready to hear the sermon. Everyone's ready to pay attention.
It to me, it smacks of emotional manipulation. On the other hand, what drama isn't? I mean, that's the point. Isn't it that the power of drama is that it involves the whole self as actor and audience, mind, body, spirit, emotions, everything. So that's another model, and then you don't have to worry with your plays about resolution. You turn that over to the minister. Now they tell funny stories about this. You got to have a minister that's really working with you. Because if he decides to change the sermon and it's Tuesday, if he's his own guy, and apparently this does happen, then they have to go back to work and put a new beginning and a middle together. But that's an interesting one.
And you say that's every week?
Every week. Every Saturday and Sunday for their searcher services. And
even on a website where you join their... they're subscribed to the service, and you can pull the script off the web.
Really?
I've done it before. Yeah. There's a church not far from me that's doing that right now.
I'd like to, we have about 10 minutes left, and a number of you here were here yesterday, and we talked about this play that's in process right now called 40 Days. And it's the story of a woman whose husband left her 8 months ago, and she starts to get her life together, gets a job, a very satisfying job, and starts to become independent, and then 8 months later the husband calls up and he says, I want to come home. Now, he's left in order to move in with an assistant in his office who's about half his age. The question yesterday sort of relates to, the questions that were raised yesterday relate to this middle, I think, at this point, and maybe a little bit to the end as well. Because the complications that face this woman of whether or not to resume her married life with her husband or get a divorce are so real and so emotionally powerful. I had somebody talk to me this morning at breakfast and said, you're just dealing with emotional dynamite right there. You know, if you do that play in church, you're just going to have people, you know, everything from walk out to being irretrievably wrecked, you know. Whatever you do, you're gonna have to have the gospel in there so clearly as to sort of retrieve people from, especially women, from who will identify with this, the central character who's a woman, from kind of just emotional despair. So I began to, I take these comments very seriously, and I listened very carefully to what you had to say yesterday. And I think before I file this play, put it away forever, I'm going to try to work with the gospel to make the gospel very clear. Yeah. And one sort of idea I had last night was that the woman Janet, the play is sort of bookended by two incidents. Janet is the reader for Sunday's service. She's the lector. And what she has to read is the story of Jesus' temptations in the wilderness. So she comes to church to work with the lector coach, who happens to be named Luke. And she reads the gospel story, and he makes a comment here or there. And then she asks the question, which is the hard question in this gospel for me and for some of the people in Soul Purpose, where's the good news here? She poses that question. We pull some of those little interpolations of the temptation story out. We've heard it loud and clear at the beginning. The story goes through with some of the suggestions, like that the husband seems too bad still. We have to find some ways to make her want, the possibility that she would want to go back with him. But at the end of the play, then, the story has been told in retrospect. She went to San Francisco, met an old college boyfriend who offered her one set of possibilities. She comes back, her husband offers her another set of possibilities, and her next-door neighbor friend offers her yet a third set of possibilities. All these seem to be temptations to her. At the end of the play, she reads the gospel again with a kind of conviction and finds the gospel in there, which is that, you know, there is one person who is able to resist these temptations and went on, you know, then to save the world, to redeem the world. That seems to me to be one possibility without making the answer so clear that of course you're going to go back with your husband, to hold up the image of Christ very clearly. Now, I don't know whether that solves the problem of the question of divorce being so sharp and hard that people are not going to be able to tolerate it as they listen to this. I don't know. Did you have some of that feeling yesterday, that this was just too hard a question to put to people?
No, I just thought that it would require an opportunity to talk. You couldn't watch that and have all of these things stirred up and then just walk out, good morning, and
yeah. You know,
there would have to be a service discussion time.
Yeah.
A decompression
time.
To
sort of vent out.
Venting. Maybe, you know, there's no one good answer to all those. Each person will have to, with God's guidance, make their own decision. I think it'd be a danger to try to say, well, of course, in all of these situations, whenever this comes up, of course you've got to reconcile.
Or shouldn't reconcile.
Or
never.
You should never, you know, you've got to, I think it would have to be open-ended and
in supportive.
In a very imperfect world, will have to be made by an individual with invited God's guidance.
See, what concerned me, and it concerned me as I was drafting this, is if the play is supposed to be about trying to know what God wants you to do, if that's what the play is about, and resisting temptation that lead you to a false answer to that question, you know, a false voice. If that's what the play is supposed to be about, that's fine. But if it becomes, if divorce is such a powerful issue that finally all that is lost and it's
only about divorce instead of about
that would
temptation.
Be a real, yeah, that would be a failure.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be, that would not be the intention.
No, because you want it to just be temptations, not divorce in our culture.
Yes. So then when I thought, well, maybe this could be a sort of you pick the story you want, so that there could be other questions put into that same structure, like, you know, should I take this job? Or shall, which would mean all sorts of life implications, or shall I stay where I am? That could be sort of one thing. Shall I marry this woman or this man? And if there were a way actually to have a sort of set, say three or four particular issues that could almost, and this sounds like we're playing games here, and we're not, but that could almost be plugged in according to, you know, maybe even a congregation could choose which one of those issues that they wanted or wanted to stay away from.
Michael, I'm trying to read. I feel the need at this moment to go back and look at that scripture to see what the temptations were.
Bread, you know, food.
When he was hungry.
Kingdoms. I can give you all the kingdoms of the world. All you have to do is worship me. And the third one was daring God to save you in desperate situations. Jump down off the temple. So one would have to find a way to find analogous temptations that would fit another issue.
Yeah, maybe that.
Yeah, because in the scripture, as you read, it's obvious what choices would be evil and which choices would be just. But in this play, it's not nearly as clear cut. They look like all those reasons could be evil if they're. All those choices could be evil if they had the wrong motivation behind them.
The reason for that being because it's not the scripture. I mean, it's not a holy book that people go by, you know. It's it's a work that has been created by, you know, by we who are the playwrights. And when you make those kinds of decisions, as you said, they're not as clear-cut, and you don't know which ones are right and wrong because we simply don't know.
I think that can be part of the power, though, of a work like this, because I think the only reason why those, at least a couple of those temptations seem obvious is because we've heard them, you know, once a year, every first Sunday of Lent or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. But what's wrong with turning the stone into bread?
Right.
What's wrong with, if we could have a world where we could feed everybody?
Yeah.
You know, if we could feed everybody, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that, Fred's, I don't know if you were, when Fred went through that, it was a really fresh way of looking at that, you know, because the subtle temptation there is if we could just take care of those problems, then it would be all right, you know, and whatever, like the situation of this woman, if I could have my financial needs met, you know,
or
wouldn't it? Then my life would be together. Then I'd be okay.
But the more you take from, you know, the more one person gets, that's something else that somebody else doesn't get.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a give and take kind of thing, so nobody really wins.
And true, you'll invent your own problems after you're fed. You know, I mean, our culture is pretty much a display
of
that.
And Jesus' reply to that is, you know, you can't live by bread alone, because precisely because, you know, yeah. human sin will be, you know, raise its ugly head there, and therefore that's not the magic bullet. But I think the dramatic power in this play is, at least with this issue with divorce, and maybe there could be other issues, is if I only had my bread taken care of, you know, if I had my finance, then I'd be all right. Or would I? You know, that's the...
So at this point, you are at least not saying shelve this because divorce is too explosive an issue to talk about in church. You might later, but at this point, you're saying work on it for a while.
Yeah, you know, but there's absolutely no question. There's absolutely no question that it is emotional dynamite, and because there are, I mean, I remember once doing a sermon on divorce that I thought was incredibly grace-filled, you know. But a woman, it was the first time really ever since her divorce, the word even had come up in church, and all she heard was my introduction, you know, and she didn't hear anything that came afterwards. Yeah, I mean, eventually it was okay, but on the other hand, I knew her well enough to know to seek her out afterwards, and then you had a lot of debriefing from that. So, I mean, yeah, it is an issue that will literally, you know, smack somebody in the head who wasn't expecting it.
Well, it's past 4:15. Thank you very much, especially those of you who are coming back. It's been a great pleasure these four times, and. I have your names, and we'll stay in touch with you, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.